executive compensation. So there's a new excise tax in town under Section 4960. It's a 21% excise tax on the employer for compensation in excess of $1 million, and also with the excess parachute payments. And so this is big. Part of it is, at least once a year, you're going to see a newspaper article that says some nonprofit executive is paid too much. Now, I won't tell you how much they're paid. It really doesn't matter, because if they're paid more than a dollar, it's probably too much in someone's mind. And so if they're making more than $1,000, more than $100,000, more than $1 million, regardless of the role or the expertise required, that's too much money because you're a charity. And you as a charity should be run by volunteers. At least that's the argument. What they don't realize, ignore the gig economy. What they don't realize is that, the employees who work there are not volunteers. They're not nonprofits. They just happen to work for one. And so the salary compensation question has come up a lot of different ways, but here it's the most egregious. I mean, if you're looking, the people you're looking at, forget the college coaches, which is one target of this. The other target is the high-level executives of major hospital systems. So nonprofit hospital systems that pay their executives very large dollar amounts to manage a very complex system that's every day in competition in lots of ways with other for-profit organizations. So, I kind of question this from a philosophical perspective again. Why are you targeting nonprofit executives that are getting paid market rates for the work they're performing, other than the fact that they're just working for a nonprofit? I leave that out there. That's my soapbox for the day. No, there's more. So that's probably not the only one. The employee is also, it's not only the threshold, it's also one of the five highest compensated. And there is an exception for compensation related to medical or veterinary services. And so I'm wondering how many college coaches are going to medical school now just to satisfy that exception. So again, colleges and universities in the crosshairs. So there's an endowment tax now. 1.4% excise tax on net investment income for private colleges and universities. And it's defined as a university that has at least 500 tuition-paying students, more than 50% are located in the U.S. That was an amendment to clarify some of the provisions. So state colleges and universities aren't incorporated into this, and there's a question as to whether that was really an error and whether that should be corrected. But the aggregate fair market value is at least $500,000 per student is one of the other requirements. And there was a notice issued by the IRS to help with the calculation of how that excise tax is calculated within the endowment. But clearly, I was listening to a Malcolm Gladwell podcast where he was criticizing universities for their misuse of their endowments. And I fundamentally don't understand the issue with an endowment. If the endowment is the ability to continue the charitable purpose and they use it for charitable purposes, I'm still not sure what the problem is. But clearly there is a problem because Congress thinks so. So now we get to the real meat of this conversation, which is unrelated business income. And this, again, is a scenario that, unrelated business income is a trade or business that's regularly conducted that's unrelated to your tax-exempt purposes. But it's not just that. There are other things that trigger UBI with respect to tax-exempt organizations. But the origin of this conversation about UBI and the reason why this has become an issue is because there was an examination by the IRS of colleges and universities on a broad basis. And what they determined through that analysis was that universities tend to report their UBI on Form 990-T. And there's this curious thing that typically happens. They have a large amount of income that's offset by a large amount of expenses. So they have UBI, but at the end of the day, because of the losses or the expenses, they end up paying zero tax. Curious, isn't it? Or you'd call it tax planning, one of the two. So the IRS looked at this and said, well, something's not right here. That really shouldn't be that if you incur tax, but for some reason you always have enough expenses to offset it, there's something not right that's going on. And part of it is that you might have something that's very profitable, on one side and another activity that may be a huge loss on the other side, and so you balance it out together. Well, the IRS said, well, you know, fundamentally you should be segregating those trader businesses into separate buckets so that we can account for ones that are either real losers that aren't really a trader business because there's no profit motive versus the real winners who you should be paying tax. And so tax reform came in with one benefit, which was reducing UBI to match the corporate rate at 21%. And they made some changes to the NOL carryovers, which we'll get to in a second. They also did other things to UBI that we'll talk about more in depth in a second as well, which was associating UBI with certain employee fringe benefits. Again, the silo and bucketing that we talked about. And there was also a question of whether UBI on guilty income and how that would be treated. So we'll get to each of those.